From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with cartoonists R. Crumb and Aileen Kaminsky Crumb about their work and their lives together. He's the father of underground comics. She was among the first women to create autobiographical comics. They each have new books. Also, a novelist from Somalia who has been living in exile finds himself in a new role. Nuruddin Farah recently traveled back to his country in the hopes of opening lines of communication between warring sides and was nearly killed along the way. He has a new novel called Knots. And critic at large John Powers considers the coverage of Anna Nicole Smith's death and why the story of her life really is fascinating. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are R. Crumb, the father of underground comics, and Aline Kaminsky Crumb, who was one of the first women to create autobiographical comics back in the 1960s. They've been married for 35 years and have lived in the south of France since the early 90s. Robert Crumb created Zap Comics in the 60s, and such characters as Fritz the Cat, Mr. Natural, the Snoid, and Devil Girl. A lot of his humor comes out of his neurosis and his obsessions, sexual and otherwise. Aline first became known for her contributions to women's comics and Twisted Sisters. They each have new books. Robert's is called The Sweeter Side of R. Crumb. Aline's book, Need More Love, is a graphic memoir that collects her autobiographical comics along with a new narrative and photographs. The Crumbs sometimes work together on joint autobiographical cartoons for The New Yorker. I asked if their personas in those New Yorker cartoons are much different from who they really are.
Kind of exaggeration of who we really are, but not that far. It doesn't deviate that far from who we really are.
Well, I think we get into our George and Gracie bit when we're doing that. I mean, I feel like I'm, you know, playing my role somewhat. And you kind of feed me lines and I react in a way that, you know, I don't necessarily do in our real life.
So what are your personas like in the cartoons?
He's the straight man. He's George. He feeds the lines, and I like take him up and run with him. And I'm like the fool, you know.
But also, you're flamboyant. You're gaudy. Crass. You know, Jewish Long Island thing that you have, and you're bold, and I'm more kind of gray and goyish and
The Jew and the goy.
Right.
You know, he's like from a Minnesota farm family, and I'm from like a long line of schmata salesmen people. You know, so.
Would you tell the story of how you both met?
Who tells it, me or you, Robert?
You tell your version, I'll tell my version.
Okay, well, I was like being a Jewish cowgirl in Arizona at the time, and I thought I was completely unique. This was like in the late 60s, or maybe around 69, 70, and I thought I was the only Jewish girl being a cowgirl at the time. I thought I was really being a wild adventuress. And then I saw a comic book called Dale Steinberger, The Jewish Cowgirl, done by an artist named R. Crumb, and I thought, this guy is like stolen my life here. How can this be? You know, and at the same time, I also saw a character called Honey Bunch Kaminsky, and my last name is Kaminsky. And I thought, no, wait a minute, this is really weird. And then I met a bunch of other cartoonists who met me and said, you look just like an R. Crumb character. We have to introduce you to him. So after I finished art school in Arizona, I moved to San Francisco, and then 2 weeks later I met Robert. And I had a strange sinking feeling that my destiny was sort of going to be forever entwined with his. And he looked at me and said, you have cute knees. And all he felt was lust and didn't think anything more. And that's my version.
Well, that's pretty much how it was. Yeah.
Robert, when you met Aline, did you think that she looked like one of your comic characters?
I was drawn to her strongly. Yeah. She had all the requirements, and you know, but yeah, my initial interest in her was strictly, you know, here's a cute hippie Jewish slut. She'd probably easy.
When did you first see her work, and what did you think of it?
Shortly after I met her, because she had just started drawing comics at that time, and she showed me this stuff that she had done in this first comics, and they were so crazy and expressionistic. I immediately found them very interesting and compelling and so deeply personal. And I'd never seen any comics like that drawn by a woman before, deeply personal. There was a few women at that time, Trina Robbins and others, who were drawing kind of feminist comics. But to me, there was two kinds. There was Trina's stuff, which was like feminist fighting hero types, you know, girl detectives and things. And then there was the hippie flowery stuff that someone like Willie Mendez was doing, that's very sweet with unicorns and stuff like that. And here's Aline. It's like ugly. It's self-deprecating. It was just very confessional. That was the first time I ever saw a woman do that ever. And it probably was the first time a woman ever did that in comics. She's like the Jean Reese of comics there.
Donna Rickles.
Donna Rickles, right.
Aline, when Robert started drawing you, did that affect how you drew yourself?
Robert's stereotype big Jewish woman was very much how I saw myself before I met him. So I can't say that it affected me that much. And my at that time, my drawings were so ugly and gross and exaggerated. They reflected my self-hatred so much that they barely looked human. That's right.
When you were drawing yourself, did you feel ever like you were exaggerating the physical characteristics that you knew Robert found most desirable?
Aileen's her early comics, she exaggerated herself in a way that made her this like hideous, ugly monster.
I just barely looked human. I just like
she
a
made
thing.
Her nose like a giant potato, and she was just this hideous monster. She looked like William Bendix or something.
This is so far. I looked like Henry Kissinger, kind of. I mean, like, it was like so hideous, like because. You know, my bad self-image that goes back to my childhood and my parents' insulting attitude towards me.
The big defining moment in Aileen's life was, how old were you?
When?
When your father said that thing to you?
14.
Aileen's in the bathroom putting on makeup, and her father comes in and says, I need to use the bathroom. Get out of here. And she says, just a minute, I'm putting on my makeup. And he says, you know, you can't shine shit.
Yeah, so that, you know, my early comics reflected that more than anything else. And, you know, I wasn't, like, that affected by how Robert drew me or drew women at all. In fact, my art, it comes from such a deep expressionistic place in myself that I don't know what really controls it or what really affects it.
And here's another thing, is that Aileen had no background in comics. She never read comics when she was a kid. She wasn't interested in comics that much. So her comics have no stylistic references to any cartoon tradition except the most like, crude, I don't know, stuff you see from like the 18th century is drawn by these like amateur cartoonists. It's just completely her own, comes out of some raw thing that like art school, she went to art school, didn't affect her drawing at all as far as her comics go. And her whole use of tools and equipment is completely unprofessional. She just...
Once I drew a comic with my foot, it wasn't that different.
Right. She could just like, get a twig and dip it in some ink and draw with it. It wouldn't make that much difference.
Yeah, it's unfiltered, artless expression, you know? It's like almost like outsider art. And Robert's work is really like well-drawn and it's full of form and perspective
I have reference to comic traditions that I'm, you know, very much into from childhood, and you just didn't have that at all.
No, I mean, I might have wanted to be influenced by him to make my drawing more palatable, but in fact, nothing worked. Nothing affected me.
If you're just joining us, my guests are R. Crumb and Aileen Kaminsky Crumb, and Robert Crumb has a new book called The Sweeter Side of R. Crumb, and Aileen Kaminsky Crumb has a new book called Need More Love, a graphic memoir. You know, in a recent edition of The New Yorker, the Valentine's Day edition, you had a joint comic that dealt with the fact that you've been married for decades, but you've both had other lovers.
Decades.
And Aileen, you're in a relationship with someone who you describe as your second husband, who I believe lives
with both of you. Tonight.
Is he really?
Yeah.
He's waiting out in
there. He's out there waiting for us.
Okay. Let me read, unless you have it with you and you could read it, I'll read an excerpt of the comic so that...
Go ahead.
Okay. So, Aileen, you start and you say, they make a big deal over the fact that I have a couple of husbands. If I was a guy, they'd think that was cool. I know I'm too intense for one person. I think the only reason you could still stand me is because you haven't been monogamous for one day of our marriage. And then R. Crumb says, yes, that's true. And you've been very, quote, understanding about it. But come on, you haven't exactly been Mrs. Goody Two-Shoes yourself. And then Aileen says, I was just imitating you. But of course, we have a deep spiritual bond. And Robert says, and an empire that would be too hard to divide up. So I'm wondering, like, for starters, is this idea of an open marriage something that you followed when you first met? Has it always been that way?
Yeah, it has. I told Aileen right away that, said, you know, if you want to be involved with me, I get, you know, because I'd been through hell with other women over this issue, you know, of infidelity, that I just couldn't help myself, you know, and I still can't. But now I'm old, it don't matter anymore at all. But those days, I told her right away, I said, I can't be monogamous. It's just not in me. If you want to live with me, you just got to keep that in consideration. She said, yeah, okay. But of course, over the years, I had to kind of keep reminding her of that. But she too, on the other hand, she's took that then as license to also not have to be monogamous. So,
well, the way I look at it is when I was first with you, it was difficult for me. And there was a point where I left you because I didn't know if I could deal with it. But then I realized, like, you're the only person I can really stand to live with on a day-to-day basis, and that I really love deeply. So I decided that nobody's perfect and I would figure out how to deal with the situation. And somehow I did. And, you know, I was only 23 when I first started living with Robert. So, in fact, I still had a lot of growing up to do and a lot of experience to live. And so in the end, I think it ended up being a good thing for me. But it's not something I would recommend anybody else, because it's a question of everybody's needs being fulfilled and satisfied and everybody sort of knowing what they're supposed to do and getting what as much as they need, maybe not too much. But in the situation now with all of us and our various other people, no one's being hurt or left out or tortured or lied to or deceived, and nobody feels bad. So I guess that's what it boils down to. I mean, the monogamous marriage is a modern invention, more or less. People lived in tribal situations, all kinds of extended families throughout history. And maybe...
Yeah. Just tell them just say we're bohemians.
Yeah.
Let it go at that.
Okay, we're bohemians. But I also think that it's important to say that, you know, it's okay if it works.
Yeah. Is jealousy something that you each suppress or that you're just not bothered by?
Oh, me personally, Aileen says I'm autistic because I just don't have jealous bone in my body. I just don't. If someone wants to be with somebody else, what am I, possess that person? I should not allow them to do that or try and stop them, or, you know, your feelings might be hurt, but I don't have jealousy. I just don't have it in me.
For me, it's much more complicated. I can't say that I don't have jealousy. For me, it depends on who Robert's involved with. Who Robert is involved with, and if I like them and they're nice to me, and people treat each other respectfully,
they're discreet, let's say.
Well, yeah, and if I don't feel that they want to take something away from me or harm me in any way, like Robert has been involved with some women who I thought were monsters that would like to have killed me, gotten rid of me, and I wasn't particularly comfortable with that situation.
Or that the one that rummaged through your closet?
Yeah,
you didn't like
that's
that.
Right. And I said I forgave her for having a love affair with my husband, but I didn't forgive her for trying on my clothes. And, you know, that was like the ultimate lack of respect, in my opinion.
You know, and as we talked about, Robert, the last time you were on Fresh Air, you know, when you were doing your comics in the 60s, they were kind of very controversial among women. I mean, some women thought they were great, but a lot of women thought that they were really, you know, kind of sexist.
Very few women thought they were great. Very few women thought they were great. It was mostly
I got a hard time from the other feminist cartoonists for going out with Robert. That was like
tell us what that was like. What kind of comments did you get about that? And what did you think of the way he drew women? Were you ever, you know, offended by his emphasis on large breasts and behinds and the kind of, you know, sexual obsessions that were, you know, described in the comics?
Tell the truth, Aileen.
Well, I was really happy that somebody liked my physical type finally. I was really flattered that that was his, like, ideal
woman. What about all
the
sick sadism and all that stuff?
Well, it corresponded with my own sick masochism. But aside from that, I thought that feminists had, cartoonists had no right to tell me who to go out with and how to conduct my personal life. And in real life, Robert's, like, was my best fan, the most supportive person I could have ever been with in terms of my work. And even though being with him may have affected the public's perception of my work, it didn't affect my desire to work at all, because he was such a supportive person to live with always. Like, he laughs at my stories more than anybody, and harder. He falls on the ground laughing so hard.
It's true. Me fall on the ground.
But the feminist cartoonist...
She'll say, I'll be falling on the ground. She'll say, well, what's wrong? You get up. Get off the ground. What are you doing down there?
But in the early women comics, there were some very angry women, and they really hated and resented Robert's work. And when I started going out with him, they started to ice me out, and then they started to reject my comics from their books, saying that they weren't, like, feminist enough. My feminist consciousness was not evolved enough. And Diane Newman was also in that group. I brought her into that early group also. We met, and I really liked her, and I liked her work. And then she started going out with Bill Griffith, so she was also iced out. And they called us camp followers, as a matter of fact, in an article in the Berkeley Barb. So Diane and I then broke off from the group and started Twisted Sisters. And we saw ourselves as feminists, but we were more like bad girl feminists that wanted to, like, have sex with men and dress in sexy clothes and play it for all we could get out of it and still be totally in control of ourselves. We thought of ourselves more as sexy Amazons, which also went along with the way Robert saw women. So, you know, when he drew things like vulture demonesses, I said, yeah, I could go with that. I kind of feel like that. Or, you know, devil girl. Yeah, I'm devil girl, you know. There's a part of me that really likes that. I'm really strong. I like to show my strength. I was always like that. I never felt victimized. I never felt afraid of anything, you know. So
I'm much more fearful and feel more victimized than Aileen does.
Absolutely. You know, so there was something that really appealed to me in his depiction of women. He was kind of the wimpy guy that was like, you know, idolized and was tortured by and fearful of women, all of those things wrapped up into one, you know, and I could relate to it.
My guests are R. Crumb and Aileen Kaminsky Crumb. His new book is called The Sweeter Side of R. Crumb. Hers is called Need More Love. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are R. Crumb, the father of underground comics, and Aileen Kaminsky Crumb, one of the first women to create autobiographical comics. They each have new books. His is a collection called The Sweeter Side of R. Crumb. Hers is a graphic memoir called Need More Love. Well, Aileen, you write about how when you met Robert, he was like really famous. And at that time,
I was only really known in the hippie subculture.
Well, that eventually he became famous. But you say he didn't handle it well, and you saw what fame did to him. What did it do?
Well, you know, since he was a reject all through high school, when he was younger, he was missing his front teeth, and he was kind of funny looking, and no woman would ever look at him. And then all of a sudden, when he got famous, like all these women wanted to have sex with him, he was like completely overwhelmed, and he just wanted it all, and he couldn't handle any of it, and he said yes to everybody, so there would be like tons of people around who didn't know what they were supposed to be doing and were just sort of like hanging around him, and created a terrible kind of chaos. And some of those people were like actually mentally unbalanced, you know. And it was the 60s and everybody was taking drugs too, so it was just a complete chaotic scene. And plus there was a certain amount of money coming in, and then rock stars were hanging around him. So
the money was completely mismanaged.
It was a very decadent, very chaotic, disgusting, unclear, you know, for me, it was an uncomfortable scene. I actually fled from that, you know, at one point. And then Robert came and sought me out afterwards, because I think that, you know, he realized he had to get out of that. It was like some kind of survival thing. But I felt that he was sinking in that, and I felt that it was going to destroy him.
Robert, is that an accurate picture?
Afraid so. When Aileen fled from it in 1974, I went after her because I realized that she's like the life raft. And I mean, I've said it in interviews and stuff before that I think if I hadn't, you know, grabbed onto Aileen, I might be dead now, because I was involved with all these crazy women. They're all crazy. And Aileen seemed to have her feet on the ground somehow. And I needed someone like that. She was the only one that was cared enough about me or was willing to, take me on. And I needed someone like that.
Aww.
Yeah.
So cute.
Aileen, is that ever a burden? Because, Aileen, like, you have all these, like, kind of, like, demons and crazinesses of your own, but it sounds like in the relationship you have to, like, be the sane one?
No, it's not like that.
No, it's not like that? Okay.
Not like she's the sane one, but that she is better at handling, you know, people. She's better at, she can think on her feet quicker. Like, mm-hmm. You know, if a journalist comes to the door unannounced and wants to talk to me, Aileen will throw him out. I just, well, okay, yeah. And like this last week in France, some journalists came there to talk to me, and I let him in, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table. Aileen comes downstairs. She looks around and says, what is this? Who are these people? How'd you get in here? And Robert told me he didn't want to talk to any more journalists. I said, Robert, what are you doing? So I was so embarrassed, I got up and fled the room. And Aileen just told those people, dégagé, she kicked them out.
And they said to me, you know, you can't control the media. I said, I can try. Get out of my house.
At first they said, who are you?
Yeah, I'm the wife. Get out. You know,
and I couldn't do that. I can't do it. I'm weak.
But going back to the beginning, I have to say that I think that, you know, I was 23 when I met Robert, and he was in his late 20s. And I think that we both came from very dysfunctional, hate to use that word, families, and that I think we parented each other. I think that,
that's,
you know,
true.
We both completed each other's childhoods in a positive way so that then we functioned much better as adults as time went on. And I think that we did that for each other. So
we did, yeah. We parented each other.
You were my life raft, too. You were the kind father that I never had.
Aww.
You and you were my best fan.
Oh, I'm gonna
and you
cry.
Really supported me as an artist, too. So I feel it's completely mutual.
Yeah. When I first met Aileen, she had a real hard edge to her from what she grew up in, that Long Island Goodfellas life. And she, and you know, she kind of lived with these rough people. And she was in Arizona. She was this crazy, rough cowgirl. And living with me, she gradually got softer. She got, like, more open. First, I couldn't look her in the eye. There was a craziness in her eyes that I couldn't barely look at.
You said I looked like a wolf.
Yeah, these wolf eyes. So she's kind of, you know, she's more, and she often will say this in a joking way that I kind of made her more civilized.
Yes, I'm a refined product now,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
I finally left Long Island. I live in a medieval village in the south of France, you know.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's I don't have to retire in Miami now.
Oh boy.
Thank you, dear.
Well, I want to thank
You're
you
welcome.
Both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Loads of laughs.
Thanks, Terry. It was fun.
R. Crumb's new book is called The Sweeter Side of R. Crumb. Aileen Kaminsky Crumb's book is a graphic memoir called Need More Love. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of In the Country of Men, a novel about a young boy living under the shadow of Gaddafi's Libya by Hisham Mater. From ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. And from Bristol Bay Productions, presenting Amazing Grace, based on the true story and song behind the abolition of the British slave trade, opens February 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk to the novelist Nuruddin Farah, who has been living in exile from his country, Somalia. He recently made a trip there in the hopes of serving as a peacemaker and was nearly killed along the way. And our critic at large, John Powers, considers the media coverage of Anna Nicole Smith's death. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The famous, or perhaps notorious, model Anna Nicole Smith died last week, prompting a tsunami of media coverage. Our critic at large, John Powers, looks at the reasons for all that coverage and says that one shouldn't be embarrassed about finding her story fascinating.
Back in the early 60s, Philip Roth wrote a famous essay about how American reality had gotten so big and crazy that it surpassed the talents of novelists to invent things. Along the way, he bemoaned the mass media's habit of creating crass, mindless spectacles. His example, get this, was the Kennedy-Nixon presidential debates. He obviously didn't foresee the recent coverage of Anna Nicole Smith's death. From the moment word came that she died, we got the predictable bombardment of news, pseudo-news, and speculation about drugs and DNA tests. And just as predictably, this frenzy became part of the story. News anchors made ironic comments about Smith being a mere celebrity, then spent the next 20 minutes covering her death anyway. And the punditry mounted yet again its collective high horse to neigh about a culture addicted to triviality. Now, the coverage was, of course, too much. This was hardly surprising, for these days, too much is the given. Still, I'm not one of those who thinks the media shouldn't waste its time on the likes of Anna Nicole Smith. Celebrities are both lightning rods for public sentiment and the screens onto which we project our fantasies. Those who stick in the public eye like Anna Nicole usually do so because they're the symbolic intersection of big social forces. In her case, these forces included 24/7 media, the obsession with fame, and a culture that celebrates naked greed. But what made Anna Nicole special was something more primal, a hyperbolic sexuality that was almost a parody of voluptuousness. She had a bod and a half, and she knew how to flaunt it. In her cartoonishness, Anna Nicole became the female equivalent of Mike Tyson, the former heavyweight champ who so often seems like a walking vat of testosterone. Both embodied a vanishing, retrograde, yet still potent fantasy of what real men and real women look like. Pushing such fantasies to crazy extremes, these icons had predictably gaudy rises and equally gaudy falls. In its contours, Smith's life was worthy of a big, sprawling 19th century novel, a latter-day Vanity Fair. Born Vicki Lynn Marshall in Houston, Texas, Anna Nicole didn't start out with many advantages. She didn't come from money. She had an eighth-grade education. But what she did have was that body and a burning ambition to be the next Marilyn Monroe. She played these cards well, becoming a topless dancer, a Playboy playmate, a guest jeans model, and eventually the wife of J. Howard Marshall, an octogenarian mogul. This marriage made her notorious as a gold digger, another iconically female role, by the way. Although when it comes to cynical calculation, I'm not sure a 26-year-old pinup has anything on the aging billionaire oil man who marries her. After that, her life was largely the flailing of a minor celebrity. Turning up fat and addled on a reality TV show, losing weight and shilling for diet pills, waging a lawsuit over Marshall's estate that reached the U.S. Supreme Court. Last fall brought the death of her son. She promptly sold his photos for a small fortune, and the birth of a daughter who may yet inherit $500 million. This possibility helps explain why we're suddenly hearing from so many lovers, real and otherwise. There's her lawyer, Howard K. Stern, whose name sounds suspiciously like a cross between the outrageous radio star and a venerable old TV newsman. And there's my personal favorite, Prince Frederick von Anhalt, a cop's son who actually bought his title from a money-starved German royal and now has the distinction of being Zsa Zsa Gabor's eighth husband. Now, it's true that Anna Nicole was not a woman of great talent, intelligence, or humanitarian instinct. Indeed, she makes Princess Di look as brainy and altruistic as Eleanor Roosevelt. Even so, I find it easier to understand her story, the girl who starts out with nothing and hustles to make it big, than that of, say, Paris Hilton, who's a cautionary tale about the soul-destroying nature of privilege. Although nearly everyone was mean about Anna Nicole in life, being an easy target was part of her cultural function, many of us were surprisingly touched by her death, and not only because it was premature. Death revealed the poignancy in what should have been obvious all along. Here was a lost soul, one helplessly caught in some no-woman's land between who she actually was and a dream of herself that made her enemies and turned her into a grotesque figure of fun. For me, the saddest thing is to see the shots of her when she wasn't pulling those overblown sex kitten faces. In repose, and without impastos of makeup, Anna Nicole Smith was a very pretty, sweet-faced young woman who could have been one of the nice girls I knew back in high school.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Coming up, the best-known novelist from Somalia tries out being a peacemaker and nearly gets killed along the way. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Nuruddin Farah is the best-known novelist from his country, Somalia. In 1974, the regime of Siad Barre condemned Farah's second novel, A Naked Needle, banned his work, and ordered his death. Farah fled the country and now lives in South Africa. He first returned to Somalia in 1996 and, as we'll hear, was taken hostage there. His most recent trip was at the end of 2006, when he was asked to help open communications between warring factions and was nearly killed along the way. Somalia has been in chaos since 1991, when warlords overthrew Barre and turned against each other. In 2004, a transitional government, made up in part of former warlords, was formed with the help of the UN and backed by the U.S. Last year, Islamists took over much of southern Somalia and the capital city, Mogadishu. They were pushed back with the help of Ethiopia's military, but for the past month, the Islamic movement has been attacking Mogadishu daily. Nuruddin Farah's novels have dealt with the chaos in his country. His new novel, Knots, is about a woman who was born in Somalia but grew up in North America. After her marriage falls apart, she returns to Somalia, where her family home has been taken over by warlords. She finds that women in Somalia are now always in danger of being attacked and raped by the young men in the militias. Women in Somalia now have to cover themselves when in public.
Women have to cover themselves up in public for two or three major reasons. One of them is, first of all, they do not want to be seen as such. And the reason is because being seen means that you attract the attention of a militiaman. The other thing is Somalia has now become more conservative in terms of Islam, more of late, in fact, in the past 20 years, the Islamic variety from Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabism, seems to have entered into the consciousness of the Somali more than before, so that Somalis who used to wear certain form of dresses that didn't necessarily cover every part of their bodies, the Somali national dress, the guntino, in fact allows the woman's body to be seen. Even though it's covered, you could, well, I mean, you don't need to imagine what it is, because you can see the breasts or side of the breast, or you could see the woman's body. And I remember in the 70s and early 80s, more and more of the Arabs, whether they were Saudis or Egyptians or even Libyans, insisting that Somalis were not Muslims anymore. But since the famine of the mid-1970s, and since Somalia has become more and more reliant on food aid, on aid from the petrodollar Arab countries, Somalis have begun to emulate the ways of the Saudis, the ways of the desert Arabs. And so more and more women have started covering themselves to an extent where you don't actually see any part of their body except their eyes.
Yeah, it seems that for women in Somalia now, in some ways, at least from a Western woman's perspective, it's the worst of both worlds. You have to cover yourself when you're in public, but at the same time, you're subjected to harassment, physical attacks, and rape by all these militias.
Exactly. And to top it all, the responsibility of holding the family together falls on the Somali women. And the reason is because men have become uselessly involved in politics, talking, without actually doing any work, any serious work.
When the main character in your novel returns to Somalia, she keeps her eyes downcast, as women must do when they're in public, but she also carries a knife under her body veil. Have you met women who do that in Somalia?
I must confess that I haven't, but I have spoken to one or two young Somali women who are dressed in that manner. And I asked them very discreetly whether or not they were carrying anything hidden. And they said they carry hidden things. I mean, one of them was carrying one of those sprays that she took from America. And I met another one who, you know.
A spray? You mean like mace or something?
I suppose so, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And she says, because if you get very close to a woman with the intention of raping, one of the ways that she could protect herself was to use the spray into the, you know, spray it into the eyes or something.
When your main character returns to Mogadishu, she also finds her family home has been taken over by a minor warlord. Is there somebody in particular you've based this warlord on?
Well, I would say that I think there are many minor warlords, and the way they behave is typical of warlords who naturally, what they do is they run control points of certain parts of the city, and they somehow raise funds for their fighters by stopping people and robbing them, and you know, by levying tax on motor vehicles that are going from one point of the city to the other. And so I would say that although it wasn't one particular minor warlord, there are many minor warlords whom I have met. I've also interviewed almost all the major warlords, with the exception of General Idid, who died before I got to him in the end.
So you've interviewed a lot of warlords, but I wonder if you've had contact, less journalistic contact with warlords. I wonder if warlords have stopped you, harassed you, hit you up for bribes, the kind of standard things that warlords do to people.
Well, when I returned to Somalia after 22-year absence and returned to the city called Kismayo, which is in the southeast of Somalia, and I was taken hostage and kept hostage in a small little room, a cubicle, for about 4 or 5 days. And therefore, I wasn't tortured, but I wasn't allowed the freedom that I needed to go around the city of Kismayo. And I was somehow, you know, word got out, and, you know, there was an article about it in the London Guardian, and was allowed to leave after negotiations between friends of one of my brothers and the warlord concerned. Since then, I have been more and more cautious, so that whenever I go back to Somalia, I arrange some kind of protection, because there are systems of protection that one can put in place. And that's what I've done. I was in Somalia as recently as a couple of months ago. This time, attempting to broker peace between the federal government that's now set up and the then Islamists who ran and ruled much of southern Somalia.
When you were taken hostage, did they take you because they knew who you were? Did they take you because you were a high-profile hostage? Were they hoping to get a lot of money in return for your release?
I think they knew who I was, but they didn't know what to do with me once they got me. And the reason is because I simply said that I wasn't willing. The warlord wanted me to carry a message to the international press and to praise him and say that he was the savior of the city, because he had just taken the city then. But I wasn't willing to do that. And the reason is because I said I wasn't going to be able to carry his message until I was free to do so. And the only way I could do so, I told him, was to be able to return to Nairobi from whence I came, so that, you know, I could talk to the press. And naturally, in the end, I didn't have to, because he realized that I wasn't the kind of person who could be bullied into doing whatever he decided that I would do.
So who is controlling Somalia now?
Now it seems the federal government controls much of the territory.
And now is the federal government Islamist?
No, the federal government is secularist.
Secularist?
Yeah. And now the Islamists are on the run. Some of them are on the run. Some of those people who are running the show in Mogadishu at the time are on the run.
And are the warlords still out of control, or are they coming back in control now that the Islamists
no, the
are on the
run? The warlords have been sidelined. This is my understanding. I haven't been to Mogadishu for the past 5-6 weeks, and so I don't actually know. But from what I hear, the warlords have been sidelined. Their militiamen have been disarmed, demobilized, and some of the militiamen are being trained to form part of the National Army.
So now that the Islamists are out of power and the warlords are out, women still have to cover themselves in public?
I don't think that they will continue to do so in the coming few months. I think women will be coming out of their, well, veiled cocoons, if that's one can put it. And the reason is because they were covering themselves for two major reasons. One is, as I said to you, because they were afraid of being, you know, attracting attention from the potential rapists and militiamen. And secondly, because the Islamists were in control of much of southern Somalia. I am hoping and I am thinking that probably we would return gradually to the usual traditional way, Somali way of dressing, which is much more, well, more relaxed, let's say, more tolerant of a woman showing, well, her natural body.
You've been living in exile, and you were not allowed to return to Somalia for many years. But you did return for the first time. Was it 1996? That was the first time you went back?
Yes, indeed, yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, one of the advantages of anarchy is that there isn't a repressive state government to prevent dissidents like you from returning home. So in a way, was it anarchy that made it possible for you to go back?
Well, it was in part anarchy. It was also in part because the president of the country who sentenced me to death earlier had been thrown out of power. And therefore, you know, I hadn't, or rather, I haven't up to now upset anyone enough for me to feel threatened again. It's very possible, very possible, that someone may not like, for example, not the novel, and therefore, you know, it's possible that that future governments may not see things the way I see them, especially if I criticize the way they run the show.
My guest is novelist Nuruddin Farah. His new book is called Knots. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Nuruddin Farah. He's from Somalia, but fled his country after the government banned his work and ordered his death in the 70s. He's made several trips back since 1996. You know, you were telling us before that you tried to broker some kind of agreement or at least open up channels of communication between the warlords and the Islamists who were fighting for control.
Between the federal government and the Islamists, yes. The president of the Federal Republic, yeah.
You're a novelist. Did you ever think that this would be one of your functions?
No. The idea never crossed my mind. It was put into my mind. It was put into my head, I should say, by the person who called me, the Islamist who called me, and said, we would like you to do this because we respect your opinion. We know that you are a secularist. I mean, he obviously said that probably you and I are not going to agree on many things, but what we want to agree on is peace for Somalia.
And you said yes.
And I said yes. I took it as a challenge. And then paid my way to Nairobi and then Mogadishu. And, you know, ran, you know, into some trouble myself, nearly got killed for my pains. I mean, I had a gun put to my head when
By who?
By, you know, at that time, it's no longer so, but at that time, between Baidawa, which is 350 kilometers to the west of Mogadishu, and Mogadishu itself, there was a no man's land in which militiamen from the clan families in that area operated. The federal government was isolated in a small town. Mogadishu was 350 kilometers away, and therefore between Mogadishu and the federal government, between the reach of the Islamists, let's say, which was 60 kilometers before Baidawa, there were militiamen who were as wild as you can ever imagine anyone. And the taxi that I was driving in was stopped, and a gun was put to my head because somebody assumed that I must be, you know, rich enough to pay him $4 or $5. And he insisted that I should get out of the car, empty my pockets, and give him the money that he was asking for. And if I didn't do that, he was going to shoot me.
Did you do it?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't, because I consulted the driver. You see, because there is always, in civil wars, there are always codes of behavior. I didn't want to alienate myself, first of all, from the taxi driver, because my hands, my life was in his hands. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do anything without consulting him. And so I looked at him, and he said to me not to pay a cent. And so I said, you negotiate with him. And then there was an argument between the taxi driver and the militiamen. And there were 20 or 30 of them, some of them sitting on the bonnet of the car, some of them on the roof of the car, making all kinds of noises. All this time, a gun put to my head. And I refused to give in, because I knew that sooner or later, after negotiations, once the negotiations start, no one is going to shoot you quite easily. I was only worried that he might accidentally pull the trigger. And I kept saying to myself, well, you know, I've written enough novels to last me, or last anyone who wants to read some of these novels, and I'm not going to panic or give in. And the negotiations went on for no less than, you know, 15, 20 minutes, until finally it was agreed that the man, the taxi driver, would pay him when he got back, because this taxi driver plied between Baidawa, where we came from, and Mogadishu.
Do you know whatever happened?
I have no idea.
Right.
I gave some money to the taxi driver.
So that the taxi driver could later pay
the
militia?
Yes, I hoped he would, but I doubt very much if he did.
Who knows if he's still alive? Can you imagine driving a taxi in conditions like
that? I think
I
would have heard if he had died.
Right, yeah. Good, okay. Do you see yourself in a way in situations like that as if you were a soldier, like willing to give your life for your country?
I wasn't actually thinking about that, I'll be honest with you. I was just thinking, you know, I said to myself, would I be able to finish the third part of the trilogy? I nearly, you know, mm-hmm. I would have asked him if he had allowed me to speak. I would have said to him, will I be able to, you know, let me finish the third part of the trilogy, then you can come and shoot me if you must.
Can you pretty well assume that the militia guy who had the gun to your head and were negotiating for the $4, that, like, they don't read?
No, they don't. They don't. They don't. As a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons why I'm interested and have been interested and will continue to be interested in Somalia, is the fact, you know, the educational structures have totally collapsed, and especially the secularist form of education. And one of the things that I have been, well, I've been trying to interest both donor countries as well as the president of the federal government and even the Islamists when I talk to them, with the reopening of the secular school systems, mm-hmm. so that people could have the possibility of going back to a secular education system where, if they wish, I mean, obviously they could go, you know, to a Quranic school. But in addition to that, I was thinking that the schools must reopen, because Somalia had a secular education system, and Somali used to be the language in which everything was taught from primary school through university in Somali, much of it, and in some European languages. And it's no longer so. And therefore, my interest in returning to Somalia, and whenever I've returned to Somalia, even when the warlords were in control, was to go to universities and schools and talk about secular education and the resumption of that responsibility by the state.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And I, you know, congratulations on your new book. And I look forward to the publication of the third book in your trilogy, and I hope you can take your time in writing it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Nuruddin Farah's new novel is called Knots. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. From Warner Home Video, presenting The Departed on DVD and high definition, including two documentaries on a two-disc set available today. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a date with John Waters. The independent filmmaker famous for Bad Taste and his movie Hairspray has put together an album of his favorite love songs. Join us for Valentine's Day on Fresh Air.
Sometimes I wish I had a gun, so you and I could be alone. You'd be my hostage for the day, and you'd do just what I say.